Hi there, Crunch here from The Radioactive, or Rad Show, a show that brings you anti-nuclear and peace news and views. On this 2020 International Women's Day, celebrating everyone who identifies as women and gender non-conforming people, we've chosen to share a Rad Show I made in 2018 called Queers Against the Nuclear Industry. This show was inspired by a phenomena I and others have noticed, which is that the anti-nuclear movement is packed with queers. Stay tuned to hear an exploration of this curious phenomena.
Because we got the alternative energy, right. Nuclear-free autonomy.
And welcome to The Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
The Radioactive Show is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge that this land has never been ceded. I'm Crunch, and today's show is about queers fighting the nuclear chain. It was inspired by a recently published article on this topic, written by Jessie Boylan, who will be my first interviewee. Jessie's photo essay was commissioned by the fairly mainstream lesbian magazine, Lottl, known as Lesbians on the Loose. Although this is a primarily lesbian-focused publication, the article and today's show will examine the idea of queer resistance to the nuclear industry. Now, in this show, I hold queer with a loose and open meaning that includes people who question the traditional gender binary and form relationships outside the heterosexual norm. Jessie's essay featured photos and quotes from five queer-identifying nuclear-free activists, including Jessie herself. We'll hear from Jessie, followed by Jem Rommeld, who is the Australian director of the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons. The song featured throughout today's show is by Eddie Donald and called Feet Ablaze. So thanks for taking time to join us, Jessie Boylan. Can you just begin by quickly introducing yourself and some of the things you get up to?
Yes, I am Jessie Boylan, as you just said. I am an artist. I work mostly in photo media and photography, video and sound. And I'm also a lecturer in photography. It's kind of what I get up to. I'm interested in, you know, using art to explore and make sense of our catastrophic time. So I've done a lot of, obviously, anti-nuclear work, exploring the ongoing legacies of nuclear testing programs and mining landscapes. But more recently, work has been about panic and the Anthropocene or the Thulocene. Yeah. Well,
thanks. There's a lot of follow-up questions I could ask. But for now, I did want to ask about your recently written article for the magazine Lottl, which was broadly about queer resistance to the nuclear industry and called This Is Not Nowhere. I'm wondering about if you could give us a brief description of the article and just about your process for compiling that article.
Sure. Well, I think it actually came about because one of the, I'm in a photography collective called Lumina, and we've sort of been asked to be the photo editors for the year of Lottl. And I proposed to present this work, which is actually from my master's project, which was called This Is Not Nowhere, Photography, the Campsite and the Anti-Nuclear Community in Australia. And so I don't think I had contextualised it around queer life, but it sort of was maybe one of the things that was missing in my actual master's, which was how most of the people that I photographed were queer and so commonly are the ones that are, in, you know, part of these campaigns or a massive part of these campaigns and so active and you know, kind of leading and have been for quite a long time, you know, since the 1970s and 1980s when there were kind of women's peace camps and the Pine Gap protests and Green M Common and all of those kinds of things. So I think I kind of actually got the chance to relook at this work and go, something that was just felt self-evident actually needed to be stated, perhaps. I think I had gone, oh, why didn't I actually talk about that before? It was just kind of a given that these were the people that I were photographing. And so I think this spread gave me an opportunity to kind of reconsider, you know, who are these people? And then predominantly they were queer. And I think that was something to celebrate and to talk and investigate more into, you know, are queer people, you know, and our queer lives, how do they intersect with activism of all kinds, but particularly anti-nuclear activism, or in this case.
And yeah, it is a really interesting thing to explore. And in the article, you suggest, from my reading, you suggest that queers can relate to those who've had their voices systematically silenced. For example, Indigenous communities who have the lived effects of nuclear weapons testing in Australia and have never had their stories recognised. What I wonder is this a simplifying of different experiences and oppressions, or do you think it's a really meaningful starting point for solidarity, or is there somewhere in between?
Well, I think obviously it is complex, and there's probably a multiple or a multitude of ways of which this is taken. And I think the idea of intersectionality is a kind of well-meaning one, in which that all of our struggles are bound up together, and that's not to lump them all in the same kind of grouping and say that therefore I experience, you know, discrimination and so I'm with you. It's kind of more an opportunity, as you say, to link struggles and to say, well, actually they are bound up together, because it's capitalism, it's imperialism, it's colonialism, it's patriarchy, and these things are the dominating forces which affect all of these, you know, different things, which are various forms of discrimination against, you know, race, gender, sexuality, class, etc. But, you know, it's obviously way more complex, and as Hillary talks about, is that, you know, the kind of stuff around, it's a privilege, obviously, to talk about this. Well, I'm a privileged person, and you know, I have the privilege to talk about it from this kind of more theoretical, or, you know, position, in which I'm not actually living a struggle, you know, on a day-to-day basis, as this, in the same way as, you know, Aboriginal people who are fighting against mining companies or fighting against the government in some way, or, yeah, you know, all of those kinds of things. So it's easy for me to talk about it in this sense, and so I'm not unaware of my position here, and I think that's what we're kind of all talking about.
So rather than equating of experiences, it's there are really interesting, I guess, kinds of identifications, or it's hard to express, isn't it, when you're trying to work out where those common points of solidarity, or even just relating to someone's experience and truly listening or hearing what that is, and something connecting in your own life where you want to take action and support or walk beside somebody.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think in terms of queer linkages is, you know, what is, by definition, when you queerify something, and this is to kind of disrupt norms, and I think that kind of lens is required in all forms of activism, and I guess, you know, to fight against such a large machine as the nuclear machine, that we need these kinds of visions that are rich and diverse and have imagination, and, you know, they sit outside and around various normative values, and, you know, they disrupt the norms. And I think that's where this kind of queer linkages with, you know, other struggles can go here we are, you know, here we are, and this is our kind of way of approaching or envisaging, you know, kind of ways in which to walk forward. And I think, you know, obviously there's the idea is actually that we walk alongside, you know, no one gets to lead the other, you know, it has to be alongside. And obviously at times to be taking steps back, of course, where that's needed, where various voices are not required, do not help, you know, to sit back and listen and to hear and to pay attention.
Wings spread wide with no words spoken.
And in particular, it was also, I think, a strong point of the article was about that the nuclear industry and complex can be read as heteronormative and patriarchal. In all of its stages, and that it's speculated that queer resistance to this is makes sense in a way, because it's actually representing an alternative. It's sort of like two very different beasts, and so then.
Well, exactly. It's disrupting it again. It's disrupting this normative, you know. Patriarchal power machine, which is that it creates this kind of, you know, non-binary kind of disruption into something that has so much power and things, you know, don't sit in this box or that box. And I think that the kind of argument is that, of course, it makes so much sense to be able to, for queers to be, you know, protesting this industry and this machine because it needs deconstructing, you know. It needs destructing. It's this kind of, you know, how can we view something with a different lens in order to dismantle the things that hold it up and keep it strong and powerful.
And you, I'm wondering if you can think of any specific protests or occasions when you have felt like you've been involved in an act of protest that has destabilised the... I'm going to say it again, patriarchal and heteronormative narrative of the nuclear industry, or when you've really felt we are something different and it's really in opposition to what we're protesting against in a real life situation.
Well, I think, you know, the Lizard's Revenge protest that I went to in 2012, and obviously there were earlier ones, which were not called Lizard's Revenge, but were kind of rock stop campaigns, and then there's been later ones since then. But I think that there was this kind of performative, celebratory queering up of resistance, which was about kind of who we all are together, and that, you know, we have to create this kind of generative space of joy and celebration amongst this kind of this power machine and this kind of oppressive system that kind of keeps causing more and more harm to people and to place, to country, to landscape and communities. And I think that the Lizard's Revenge protest that I went to had this kind of absolute magnificence in its performative you know, protest, that it was unafraid of the kind of powers that were there. There were, you know, obviously the police force was kind of, it was so disproportionate. You know, we had over 300, I think, police officers there, and we had helicopters and all of that kind of thing for a camp of maybe 500 people. I think it was kind of amazing to see how kind of unafraid and also, you know, just this is who we are and this is where we are and we're here, you know, alongside Aboriginal elders and Aboriginal communities to do this and to be here and where, you know, I think this kind of ways in which it can shine. And
yeah, I totally agree. I think there's nothing quite so striking as a community, you know, a temporary formed community right next to a uranium mine, which is really highly regulated and ordered and controlled. And then you have a creative, colourful costume sort of festival, which is just, yeah, the contrast there is kind of, I think, even for those who are working at the mine or the police or the media, it's also, it's just a really visual and immediate clash of worlds in a way, or a sort of, you know, showing two alternatives alongside each other.
So I think it's really interesting. Sorry, it was just really interesting because obviously it's in you know, the South Australian outback, outside the the gates of Olympic Dam at Roxby Downs, and so by definition you're invisible. You know, the only visibility comes through media and the kind of imagery that gets, you know, taken from those events and fed back to, you know, various forms of publication and outlet and memory making and history and you know, this kind of idea of visibility in a place that's invisible, you know, out of sight, out of mind, I think was also a big part of those kinds of protests, which you know, are the ones that are located kind of in the outback, in the desert, in Australia, which kind of make visible places like that.
There's a place that won't diminish.
You're tuned to The Radioactive Show with Crunch and have just been hearing an interview with Jesse Boylan, or JB, speaking about queer resistance and alternatives to the nuclear industry. JB is the author of a recent photo essay, This Is Not Nowhere, which was published in the magazine Lottl and can be found online. That's L-O-T-L. Jem Rommeld was one of the activists photographed and interviewed in this article. You'll hear from her now. Thanks for joining me for a chat, Jem. Can you start out by introducing yourself to listeners? Some may remember you as a former Rad Show producer.
That's right. Yes, I was a Rad Show producer and anti-nuclear activist and working as the Australian director of ICAN, which is the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons.
Great. Now, I'm really glad that you've joined us for a chat because we are having a look at queers against nukes in this episode, and it was partly inspired by an article that has recently been published by Jesse Boylan, which was just exploring the link, or if there is one, between queer people and resistance against the nuclear industry. I'm going to read a quote from you in that article and see if you can expand on that a bit for us or explain what you mean. So this is, you have said, some say the nuclear weapons ban treaty is queering up nuclear disarmament because it undermines dominant patriarchal discourse around nukes, prioritizes or at least amplifies marginalized voices, countries and people impacted by nuclear testing, and is radically changing security frameworks worldwide, putting nuclear-armed states and their allies on the defensive. Great quote.
Thank you.
Perhaps it's quite a long one. It's early on you say about queering up nuclear disarmament. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I guess there is a fairly dominant story that we're told by the nuclear weapon states about nuclear weapons and why they are important weapons to them and why they are relevant in our world, why they keep us safe and why they are the ultimate instruments of power. So this is the dominant narrative that the nuclear-armed states and many of their allies have been maintaining for decades now, and Australia is complicit in that kind of language. You know, our government says that nuclear weapons, the nuclear weapons of the United States, are essential for the security of Australia. So directly saying that, you know, these weapons of mass destruction are important and relevant and keep us safe. Whereas the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty undermines that discourse completely, and the process that led to the treaty really threw that discourse on its head. So this process has come to be known as the Humanitarian Initiative, which was a process of conferences between governments and civil society that focused global attention on the humanitarian impacts of the weapons. So instead of just looking at the weapon as a weapon that is in your security policy, instead looking at what are these weapons, what do they do, what are the real world implications of them. So it became really clear that these weapons are actually instruments of genocide. Do not make us safe, and they're part of a system that upholds violent masculinities as a legitimate form of state power and as a method to gain security. So the Ban Treaty, which came out of these meetings, instead of having a few countries saying these weapons make us safe, you had the rest of the world saying, no, these weapons threaten all of us, and we're in the majority, and we actually have a collective power that can override you. So they negotiated this treaty, and this treaty now says that, you know, these weapons are not a tool of security. They're instruments of mass murder, and people are still suffering from them today. Not only the Hibakusha in Japan, but people around the world who've suffered from nuclear testing, and this is largely Indigenous people as well, including from Australia and the Pacific.
When you're just to, because there's a lot there in what you're saying, just to spin out some of it, when you're saying about the differences in the process of how it's regularly perceived, the, you know, type of discourse about nuclear weapons and very state-based and sort of upper levels, not a very democratic type process, is that what you're contrasting with the humanitarian process, which is like centered people and the human effects?
Yeah, it's countries that use this language, and also the nuclear weapons industry and the kind of academic field of foreign policy, all of these conservative think tanks that write papers and back up these arguments as well, and they often imply that you're kind of irrational and emotional to talk about the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons, and that it's really naive and idealistic to actually pursue a world free of nuclear weapons. And many of these voices said, oh, you'll never be able to get a nuclear weapon ban treaty. But we've proved them wrong, that actually it is realistic and rational to pursue a world free of nuclear weapons. We've banned nuclear weapons, and it's also completely irrational to think that we can keep 15,000 nuclear weapons in our world without any of them ever being used, whether that's by accident or on purpose. And any use of nuclear weapons would be catastrophic.
Yeah, so that is really interesting, that they're deeming the dominant deeming of what is irrational tends to be those kinds of insults or marginalizing that, you know, traditionally happen towards women or female gendered people, but also extends to like queer communities or gender non-conforming, the idea that it's not too much of a long bow to compare that type of othering, I guess. Do you find that even in the language, like directly the language that is used by the real politic or the state-based language, is that gendered? Or also, you know, could you say that there's a sort of heteronormative language within that, or is that going too far?
That would be really interesting to read over some of these documents to consider that. I think there is definitely a gendered language that is used around nuclear weapons. And it is often implied that we're living in fairyland to be pursuing nuclear disarmament, and that it's this sort of emotionally appealing idea, but it's not realistic. It's this contrast of sort of ideas and theories and hopes and dreams compared with what is real, which is also bizarre because, in a sense, nuclear deterrence is this theory, and it's an idea that is promoted and used to maintain the industry around nuclear weapons. So, I mean, that is this kind of fairyland. If you think that these weapons will not be used when there are so many still in the world. And I've just been reminded of a meeting that I once had with an Australian politician who said, we live in the land of the real. And he was saying that in a way to defend Australia not supporting the nuclear weapon ban treaty and saying we have to have these weapons to protect us. And that was just, I think, demonstrated how deeply entrenched this idea is of nuclear weapons being inevitable and permanent. But, you know, to counter that, we are really, we're really thrilled to have this new treaty is actually currently undermining the nuclear arms states. And one more thing I want to say on that is that the ban treaty came about because of largely countries in the global south who banded together and in many cases worked to make illegal the weapons of their former colonizers. So countries in Latin America, Africa and the Asia Pacific, these are all of the countries that said, no, it's not only the nuclear weapon states that have a voice in this. This is up to us as well, because the effects of nuclear weapons don't cross borders. They affect everybody. So our voices are relevant in this debate. And while we can't disarm weapons that we don't have, what we can do is make them illegal, and that will increase pressure on the nuclear armed states to disarm. And it's all of these same countries that will be the ones to make the treaty enter into force, to bring about the numbers for signing and ratification, to make it become international law. So these countries have all been crucial to the process, and they have actually led the process in many ways.
Moving back to the power shift of queers taking on the nuclear industry, I know ICAN has a cleverly named, is it a subgroup or a chapter called ICAN. Could you tell us a bit about how that came about and what is ICAN?
Yeah, so ICAN is the International Queers Against Nukes, and this is a very loose, amorphous body of people. We pretty much made a banner and then took it to New York when the ban treaty negotiations were happening, and we launched ICAN by marching in the New York City Pride March in 2017. And this was largely a way for the queers within the movement, which is a, you know, international movement, to band together and to explore the nuclear weapons debate through creativity and through humour, and just to give us another platform to make different kinds of arguments and to also explore the different oppressions that nuclear weapons are bound up in. So talking about those gendered impacts and what we were talking about before, about how race intersects with who has the power to talk around nuclear weapons.
Excellent. And how was that received when you...
Yeah, it was really fantastic. We gained a lot of supporters very quickly and lots of people who want to be part of ICAN. So we extend the invitation to any self-identifying queers around the world to be part of ICAN, and you can use it to march in parades or to have actions and to basically be as creative and outrageous as you want. In taking on the nuclear industry in all of its ways, shapes and forms all around the world.
Well, what an invitation. Thanks, Jem. That was Jem Rommeld, Australian Director of ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Please look up the valuable work of ICAN and their campaign to get Australia to sign onto the nuclear ban treaty. And if it interests you, check out ICAN as well. Earlier in the show, we heard from artist Jesse Boylan, author of the photo essay This Is Not Nowhere, that was the inspiration for today's show. Check out Jesse's website, jesseboylan.com. And music on today's show has been by Eddie Donald. The Radioactive Show is produced on Wurundjeri country in Fitzroy, Melbourne, and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network. You can podcast our shows at 3cr.org.au. I'm Crunch, thanks for listening, and here's to a nuclear-free future. You've just heard a Radioactive Show from 2018 called Queers Against the Nuclear Industry, shared as a part of 3CR's 2020 International Women's Day special. Remember to check out resources and groups mentioned in the show, ICAN, International Queers Against Nukes, and Jesse Boylan's work can be found at jesseboylan.com. I'm Crunch, and thanks for listening.